cliffcentral.com.
It's TLC with Unpretty. All right. At the beginning of the year, I wrote this this blog about how we should start the year and kind of what we should look for and how we should try to make ourselves a little bit happier in 2017. Because I think there are a lot of people who are walking around very dissatisfied with life, and they complain, and that gives them, it gives them a reason to be, you know, they like to complain. And I've fallen into that myself sometimes. I think we all do. We're all prone to thinking that we're better or worse off than everybody else in any given day. And then we meet other people and we realize, hey, it's not so bad. But this year, I one of the things that I put in the blog is that I feel I don't need to be as connected to what's going on social media as I might have been in previous years. That's not to say I'm going to go quiet and you're never going to hear from me again. But I just find like the whole thing has become just a little bit toxic. It's just become a little bit ugly in terms of the amount of narcissism you see on there, in terms of the amount of people telling other people what to think and do on there, thought control, everybody policing each other, kind of telling each other what's funny and what isn't and what you should laugh at and what you shouldn't. And also the showing off, the Instagram showing off, the just people posting pictures of how great their life is when their reality is very far from that. And I thought, you know what, we need to get Dr. D in here because she's smarter than me and she knows more about this stuff and she's been dealing with this her whole life in terms of figuring out how the psychology around it works. So we've got her in here today. Hello, Dr. D. How nice to see you.
Gareth, really good to see you. I don't know if I'm smarter than you at all.
I think you are.
In fact, well, I mean, you see, this thing, we're already starting off by defining ourselves in relation to other people, which is exactly what you're talking about,
exactly
isn't it?
We shouldn't
which
do.
Is exactly what you're talking about in the beginning. And yeah. I think you 100% social media does do that. And I think it does that in a huge, huge way. And I also picked up that you thought, well, you know, how good is this and how cool is this? And where are we bordering on something that perhaps started off as possibly being promoting and affirming to now being really over the top and destructive? And I
is
think
a,
it is.
Is there a cycle to this?
Well, I think that there's a continuum to it, absolutely. Look, I mean, you said, and I think in your little note in the beginning, what about recognition? If we need recognition, and does that mean that we don't get enough attention? And if that's the case, why do we need to get it on the social media? If we are really attention deprived or recognition deprived, what's wrong with us and do we need a therapist?
So that's why you're here to be our therapist this morning.
Well, I think that recognition is like soul food, actually. I think that it's not a bad need. I think it's a human need. I think everybody needs some kind of recognition. I mean, even in the way that we conduct our lives. Can you imagine? I was busy last night. My son had a few people there, and they were watching soccer, and the fans were cheering and singing and so on. And I thought to myself, probably because I knew we were talking about this kind of thing today. Can you imagine a soccer game if there was nothing the whole way through?
If people sat like they do at a...
They just sat and they didn't spur people on and they didn't say, you know, go guy, and they didn't say, well done. All of that, I think, really, you go to the gym, you work out, you feel good about yourself, you may post a pic or two, you get a lot of likes. Okay, that's fine. I think it's to do with duration and extent. Are you defining yourself by external and normative demands that aren't even real? These kind of demands, as you said, are perception. You know, usually what people post and so on is how great things are. And as you said, it is absolutely true. It's far from reality. Mm. Absolutely far from reality. So I think it's gone over the top. I think it's taken away a lot of the need to develop a way of being a little bit vulnerable sometimes and real and authentic and getting those needs met properly. So, you know, I mean, look at friends on Facebook. You can have 6,002 friends. And I say to you, well, how many do you know?
Yeah.
Who is a real friend, actually? What is a friend? You're lucky in your life if you've got five, you know, who really have your back, who care about you when the chips are down. It might be acquaintances that you have, and maybe not even acquaintances.
But so I think we've become... Let's just talk about this grading of friendship, because It is difficult. We are human. We crave relationships. We crave connections. And even the coldest among us has to have someone they can talk to. There is no point in being alive as a human if you can't connect with other humans.
Well, I think that if you can't, or if you won't, there's a problem on both. Sometimes people can't. They just don't have the it's often to do with confidence and very, very low self-esteem. Mm. No, they feel that they're not worthy of love and belonging. And if they're not worthy of love and belonging, you know, they don't put themselves out there, they might become quite isolated. Their self-esteem is low, and that has huge amount of ramifications, not only on their personal relationships, but also on their work. So that's the kind of group, if you like, that's the cohort that you were talking about that definitely needs some sort of therapy.
I think they're the exception, not the rule.
Absolutely the exception. But then there's the other kind who just don't see it really. Also the exception, the huge exception, we call them psychopaths. Who just don't want to, they don't value relationships. They don't know how to make them. They don't feel any guilt for other people. They don't, they just see themselves as being able to function perhaps even better without having incumbents and other people who they've got to think about. And those are, it's an extreme personality disorder, and both of those sides of the continuum, either can't or won't, are the exception. But what about all of the rest of us?
All right, so the rest of us, I hope, are in the middle.
Yeah.
And that's probably healthy, but there are different grades of that as well.
Yes, of course.
So what kind of, when you talk about Facebook friends, or you talk about likes, or you talk about acquaintances, and you talk about the people you really connect with, there's a limit to the number of really meaningful connections you can make in your life.
Exactly. So I think the first two...
You could meet everybody, but you're not going to remember everybody.
But I think that's the whole point. I think out of the three groups that you said, likes, connections, and people who, the way you put it, really connect with, the last group are the meaningful group that are different. You know, they are the ones who will be there for you, and those are the ones who are, if you look at the definition of what a real friend is. The others are friends in inverted commas, and it's interesting how we've adopted the terminology and just expanded it, and through the expansion perhaps have diluted it. What is a real friend? You know, a friend is someone who you can call on perhaps in the middle of the night. A friend is someone who will show up for you, you know, unconditionally when times are really tough. So we call acquaintances friends, and sometimes people who we don't even know we call friends. So the need for real friends, I think, is still there, perhaps even more now than ever before. But real friends who, as I say, who will show up. These are people who you might know and you can brag about. I've got millions of friends on Facebook, but what's the definition of a real friend?
Well, the number I was looking for is called Dunbar's number. So it's a suggestive cognitive limit to the number of people with whom you can maintain stable social relationships.
Okay, interesting.
And these are relationships in which an individual knows who each person is and how each person relates to every other person. Dunbar explained it informally as the number of people you would not feel embarrassed about joining uninvited for a drink if you happen to bump into them in a bar. And the number is regarded to be about 120 to 150.
See, I think, you can, that's one definition. And I think it's quite a broad definition. 100 sort of friends is, I think, big. It's a big number.
A lot of people, yeah.
It's really a lot of people. And maybe, you know, we can perhaps expand what we used to call a true friend. Perhaps the way I'm thinking about it, and maybe some of your listeners can call up and say what they think about it, or you, is too narrow.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of true friends, friends who will show up for you unconditionally and will be there in support of you. And that's perhaps more and more rare, or perhaps not more and more rare, but rare, and to be really valued. 100 people, 120 people who you can just knock on the door, I still think it's fine to call them friends. Why not?
Mm.
You can call them friends, so perhaps we should accept that definition of what friends are. But in terms of thousands of people who you say are my friend on Facebook, pick one or two out of a hat, you probably would be hard-pressed to know who they really are.
Would you be one of those people who would suggest that it's healthy to go in and do a cull on your Facebook friends every couple of years? Or even every year. I know people who do that. They go onto Facebook and they go, oh, I've got, you know, 2,000 people on here. I've got to chop those numbers back down to...
I think it depends very much on... No, I think it's really, if you define yourself, which you might, about the number of people that you can collect and who would follow you and who would be... You can expand your definition of friends. Why not? Everyone does. So you can say, you know, you've got... I don't know, millions or whatever it is. That's an exaggeration of friends. Depends on what you want. What is your definition of a friend? Is it someone who you know? Is it someone who you call on? If your definition needs to be narrower, you can say, I'm not applying that definition to the social media. I'll go along with the norm of what they define as friends. I know who my friends really are.
Mm.
I can count them, probably not 100, maybe more like 20, if you're lucky. Of real friends who will show up for you unconditionally no matter what. So you want to collect them fine. Does it look good? Certainly, I think that if you're in the media and you've got lots and lots of followers, I think it does look good. Because I think it's an indication of your popularity and you want that because it just generates more popularity. If what you're really wanting is to collect people who will stand in for you when you're sick or, you know, who will care about you really or your children or whatever, well, it depends on what your need for friends are. I think where it becomes a problem is that the definition of a friend has become incredibly diluted.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just expanded. And what it really means is a collection of people who I might vaguely know if you're lucky. Whereas what we used to call a friend is someone who would, you know, who would act in the old-fashioned way, if you like, as what a friend would do.
There are different ways of behaving in real life and in social media. But in real life, I mean, even in Johannesburg versus Cape Town, in Joburg, people are much more likely to pitch up at your house and say, hi, I'm here. I was in the area. I thought I'd pop in. That doesn't happen in Cape Town.
No, I think that there are those differences. Sure.
So that's a kind of difference in real life. But in social media, do you have those people who, you know, they're there all the time. They take an interest in all your posts. They either like the things that you put up or they make a small comment there, but you don't really talk to them. You haven't seen them in maybe years.
You know, I'm thinking as you're talking.
They're almost like a witness to your life going on, but you don't really connect with them at all.
You know, I'm thinking in as you're talking about it is maybe the view that I have of a friend is perhaps the traditional view. Perhaps, you know, Gareth, that's old-fashioned. Maybe we can say that today, if people follow you or if they like what you post or whatever it is, you know, we don't – let's not be critical about it.
Mm.
Let's just say that's great and that perhaps, you know, what we see is even people like, you know, Donald Trump and tweeting and using and so on. What happens is that there's a kind of a connection then between people who are all on the same wavelength. You know, is that really bad? And then maybe at times you can mobilize them and they will come to the fore with an opinion or for you when you really need it. Maybe we need to redefine the old-fashioned view, perhaps dilute it in a little bit and redefine the old-fashioned view of what a friend really is.
Well, there is such a thing, though, as narcissism, and where you're so self-absorbed and self-involved that it and then social media just becomes a massive mirror for you to show that narcissism off to the whole world.
I think that's
how do you draw the line?
Yeah, I think that that's absolutely true, and I think that it's not only true but dangerous, because what you're going to show the world isn't the whole of the person. You selectively show the world parts of you that you want them to see and particularly want to admire, and not everybody is like that all the time. So what you're saying is that it's diluting the reality of the person.
Mm.
It's a selective reality. I'm just showing you the parts that I really want you to see.
It's all been photoshopped.
Absolutely.
And, you know.
It's all been photoshopped. So that's diluting the term friend.
I saw someone's photo the other day, their profile picture on Facebook.
And then you met them.
No. I didn't even – I saw this picture. They had used so many filters, they didn't even have features anymore. Mm. They were basically mubs. They looked like a blob of plasticine that had been smoothed out. there were two holes where the nose used to be, and there were these two eyes that had been blown up so that they looked like alien eyes. This was the person's profile picture, and it clearly had been doctored, but to the point of this person being unrecognizable. And I thought, what the hell?
You see, I think that that's so symbolic, because not only the picture that's been doctored, it's their life that's been doctored. And they portray a view of life that they want other people to see and that they believe other people will want to connect with. And very often, the more you doctor it and the more photoshopping of your life that you can do, you know, the less of the reality is. And in a sense, I guess in one sense, the more lonely you are because you can't show your vulnerability. You can't show the fact that, you know, you're also a member of the human race and you don't cope sometimes. And you can't show the fact that, you know, you are uncertain or you're jealous or, you know, whatever. And so all of that has to be masked or and hopefully kept for a few select people. But I think often because of the value that is put on maintaining that kind of mask and image, which becomes featureless. I think it's amazing in the way you put it, because in fact it really does become unreal and you lose your features and you lose your reality. So what are you in the end? You know, you're kind of just a mask that you want a million likes for, but to connect with you really, to say, you know, sometimes I don't really cope or I don't look that gorgeous or I do get jealous sometimes. You know, no one posts that stuff on the social media. You know, not sort of blatantly like that anyway, maybe in closed kind of sites. So I think that it has accelerated the need to portray a kind of image that people maybe don't really connect but wish to connect with. It's a sort of aspirant thing in a way. Yeah. I'm thinking about that.
Well, you said the word admire earlier.
Yeah.
That we want to be admired.
You know, and I think that it's extremely, I mean, it might sound like I'm sort of disparaging of the social media, you know, I'm disparaging of certain aspects of it because you also get a whole dynamic that's called groupthink. You know, I know when I was so involved in working on the Oscar trial and whatever it was, you know, here were on the day of the verdict or whatever, something like almost 400,000, you know, tweets that came in. And I think that people just, you know, the need to feel part of a group and be connected with other people is also great. With it, I think that in some way it dilutes people's individual opinion because a need for connection overtakes it. Sometimes it's, you know, it's really, it's a negative kind of thing.
How do you define this groupthink thing? Because this is interesting and there's a lot of that going on.
Yeah, I think that groupthink is the need to be perhaps not question your own opinion and put it forward to the extent that you really would because of the need to belong to a wider group. And also to become kind of infected, if you like, to pick up the sort of group virus and to go along with the group because of such a deep underlying need that we all have as human beings. We all have the need for recognition. It's like soul food, and we all have the need to be liked. So one thing that, you know, I've known you for a long time, which I think we're not doing a sort of personal thing, but I think has always made you stand up and differentiate yourself.
Oh, she's going to give me a therapy session here live.
It's not really a therapy session. It's a recognition session. You know, that you'll state your case, and there have been many times where it's got you into trouble. And I think that there have been many times as where when you've withstood that and you've kept your ground. But you need to have, this is like Pat Gareth on the back day, not really, but you need to have a level of confidence. And your need for your own opinion to be recognized and heard, irrespective of whether it fits in with the norm, requires a certain amount of confidence. For a lot of people, especially younger people with a need to belong, you know, the need to belong is often paramount to even thinking about your own opinion. So, you know, somebody gets on the bandwagon, you admire that kind of person. In a sense, you want to be like that kind of person. Mm. You want to be popular and part of that group. And that need for belonging and that need for recognition can actually even mask your own opinion, which either you might not have thought about or becomes buried. So you can jump on the social media bandwagon now and feel connected to thousands of people in a way that might have been difficult for you before. And in that sense, it meets a tremendous human need, which might overtake the value of the real opinion.
What about, and it's linked to groupthink, I suppose, what about this idea that certain people want to police other people's thoughts? This is a very human need as well, the need to control other people and to project your opinions onto them. And I suppose we've all been guilty of it at some stage. Parents are probably guilty of it with their own children, where they try to make their children conform to their own mores and norms and religious ideas and everything else. But it seems to me like it's caught on where society, in inverted commas, decides certain things are acceptable and certain things are not acceptable, whether they're opinions, behavior, I don't know, thoughts, whatever they might be.
I think you're 100% right, and it's quite dangerous because now we have the tools, you know, in the social media. Before, that kind of power of influence, I mean, we always had it. If you're talking about it in the very, very extreme way, there were cults.
Yeah.
You know, there was this need for belonging is so paramount. It's such a human need, you know, that people will make up their minds basically without fact. I mean, if we're talking about, which we're not going into in any way today, but if we're talking about the Oscar Pistorius trial, you know, people would say things to me because I was very involved with that trial. They'd say, but, you know, what do you think? I might say, well, you know, maybe we should wait for the evidence. And they'd look at me as, you know, what do you want to do that for? Are you
mad?
Rather
just have an opinion without fact.
You know, but everybody knows what happened. You know, we all know what happened. And I think that the need to connect with other people in an opinion is so strong. The need for belonging is such a huge central need that it might mask, especially if your need for belonging, you know, is really great. It might mask your own individual thought and your need to establish truth and fact. I'm part of this group, and the feeling of being accepted and part of the group is very, very strong. So, you know, and now with the power of the social media, I think the influence of that and going along with something, there are many, many people. I'm vastly generalizing now. Many, many people.
No, but we're trying to break it down.
Yeah, you know, but who would disagree with that and stand up to it? But the power of that, the tools to meet that need today through the social media is great, and I think promotes the need even more.
Well, again, what kind of people, is it a normal thing for people to try and enforce their own stuff onto others?
Look,
where does that come from? What's the genesis of that? Does that come from those cults? Does it come from religion? Does it come from people not enjoying? I mean, if we look at instinctively where we were as humans, kind of hunting and gathering in the beginning, was an opinion that was different to the opinion of the tribe, or let's say the general agreements the tribe had made around certain things. Someone who comes in has a different point of view. That could destabilize the tribe. Is that where it comes from?
I suppose a biological determinism, as you're talking about, and a kind of need to support the tribe and be part of the tribe, as it relates to survival,
yeah,
is what you're talking about, because if you don't, it might endanger the tribe. I think that's fascinating, you know, and maybe there's some kind of, you know, long-term buried genetic predeterminism still, you know, in to be different. But I think that we project, you know, I think it's more simple in a way than that. I think we need power. We need status. We need recognition, you know. And I think that either to get it by not conforming to the tribe, because you do have an honest and real opinion that you've thought about and that you believe in, you know, I think is one thing. But then, if you start getting a huge amount of flack, and perhaps the way you think about yourself and perhaps some level of support from people who really matter to you isn't strong enough. The need for this need for belonging is such a paramount human need. Need for love and belonging is a paramount thing, to the point that people will compromise themselves for it.
And that also isn't healthy.
No.
Like, you've got to have a bit of both.
I think you've got to have a bit of both. I mean, and the healthy is being able to understand other people and state your case.
Yeah.
You know, but also have some sort of, this is one of the main criticisms, which I'm sure you've just deconstructed many times, and it's been so all over the media about the new president of the United States. Mm. So many people say, you know, I don't even know enough about his politics. It might not be his politics, you know, that is up so upsetting. He could be fantastic. And so it's the person, you know, bombastic, narcissistic
he's
way.
He's all id, isn't he?
What that means is that he just speaks out and acts impulsively according to his impulses without much thought. I think he's id and his ego, you know, which means, I mean, there's definitely sort of a touch of narcissism, all of which, when it gets translated into policy and action, depending on who he surrounds himself by, might not really come across as bad. But what we're saying, what you're talking about, is that have an opinion. How do you instill a kind of a self-esteem and an ability to have an opinion that might differentiate from the tribe in somebody, in a child who's growing up? In some ways, we've overdone it. We've told them that they're fantastic and their opinion counts and whatever you think. And there's a very nice, on TED Talks, there's someone called Sinek, I think his name is. I'm trying to think of his first name.
Simon Sinek,
there you go. You know, who just talks about how parents have overindulged by making kids feel that they're so special that whatever they do is amazing. And then when they confront the real world, they find out that it's not like that at all. You know, I think that it really is, all of this is balances. And it's to do with, when it comes to other people, your opinion counts, but so do others. What about respect? You know, what about, you don't have to win by denigrating. You can win by having a different opinion. It doesn't have to be, you know, a competition. It can be both and, instead of either or. And I heard someone, it was Tom Friedman actually, speak, where he said the golden rule today with the social media and the power of the destructive nature of the social media that there is, and how you can, you know, just influence so many things with a push of a button, that the golden rule is more important today than ever, the golden rule of life. And that's to do with, you know, I don't know if you know what I'm talking about.
The golden rules, it's present in almost every kind of religion and in every kind of guiding principle for humanity. It's just to treat others as you wish to be treated, right?
100%. And I can't tell you, you know, when I've spoken about this, because I heard him speak quite recently, the golden rule. There are a lot of people say, what do you mean? You know, what is the golden rule? That is it, exactly what you said. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. It doesn't mean agree with others. Mm. It doesn't mean you can't state your case. It just means, you know, in some kind of way, have some sort of respect, have some sort of recognition of the role of other people. And that, perhaps today, is more important because of the destructive nature of social media.
But how many of us are actually capable of that? I mean, if I just think back to the different ways that I've treated a friend in the past or an ex-boyfriend.
Oh, my buddy's, she's horrendous.
No, well, we've all done horrible things to somebody else that we know if they were done to us, we wouldn't like or appreciate. We're all guilty of that.
Of course we are. But I think the fact of having a value of it, I mean, you've just actually confirmed what I've said right now, because you've used the word guilty of it. The way that you expressed it to me right now shows that you don't think that's a very good thing to do or to promote. You know, you've just done it.
She's not a psychopath.
You're definitely not a psychopath. People slip up.
I beg to differ.
So, well, Gareth, what would make you work with a psychopath?
She's a very entertaining psychopath.
Actually, they can be quite entertaining because they're just not incumbent by guilt. They don't care what they do or say, you know, so they can be hell of a entertaining actually, and they can go home and just carry on without any conscience whatsoever. But, you know, in the way you said it already indicates that you think that it's not, you're sorry sometimes, it's not a good way to be. People often lose their temper or say things that they don't mean to say or whatever. But the fact that you know about it is saying something.
Well, Mub said this morning, we were listening to a clip of Madonna at that women's march. And she was saying how angry she was. And she's thought about blowing up the White House, is what Madonna said. And Mabale said quite rightly, I thought it was very profound. She said, she's just angry. A day or two passes and she goes, oh, I shouldn't really have said that.
Mm-hmm.
And she comes down from it and she says, look, you know, I said this. And I didn't mean any harm by it. I was just being emotional.
You see, previously, before social media, you could be in a march, and I was in many in my day, I can tell you.
You were?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, with being thrown into jail a couple of times.
And if you were thrown into jail?
Yeah.
What did your parents say?
Yeah. You know, my parents...
Dr. D in jail.
Yeah, I was.
Jesus Christ.
I was.
Really?
Two occasions.
What happened? What did you do?
During the student protests and a whole anti-apartheid regime. Anyway, but what I'm saying
now
is with Madonna.
Hi, Mom. I can imagine Dr. D. Imagine Dr. D.
Hi, Mom. I'm in jail.
Dari, is that you?
Yes, hi.
No.
What the hell are you doing in jail?
I was just protesting against the apartheid regime.
No, actually, it was a hell of a lot more than that.
Really. What was it?
One day I'll show you things. I was in the front lines, Gareth. There was
really?
Big student activist
Look
in my
at
day,
you.
in my day. So now, yeah, but you're hard-pressed these days to meet people who weren't. You know, everybody says they were. Everybody says that they were against the struggle.
But
and
you've
this
got
and
photographs
this and
to prove.
But I've got front-page press photographs.
You've got to have the evidence.
In tiny little mini skirts with long boots. And long hair to prove it. And now I have. But anyway, what I'm talking about is a new danger, because that comment that Madonna made now is everywhere and all over, probably, in the social media in 1 second. You know, and then you hold someone to it. And what did you say? And it gets unpacked and it gets deconstructed. People aren't forgiving in 2 days' time. You know, no, I didn't really mean that. And I've calmed down a little bit about it now. You know, it just, it means that you are in the front of a lens all the time, and these things become contagious and really get out of hand and so on because of the social media.
But do you think a lot of people use being emotional also as an excuse, and I'm not saying Madonna in this case. I don't believe that, you know, she should go to jail for what she said, for example. But there are people who say, but I was just emotional. I mean, you know, that's an excuse husbands have used when they murdered their wives. That's the excuse that some people have for saying the most horrible things to each other.
Don't you think that's a great excuse, Gareth? I mean, you know, people are emotional beings. They do all sorts of things when they're emotional. No, clearly what is really interesting it's being human. In a sense, it's being emotional. But do you know what the real definition of emotional intelligence is? The real definition is understanding your feelings, what triggered them and why, and then how you deal with them intelligently. It's the integration of head and heart. So no longer are we saying about emotion and our emotion is bad, because if you take that emotion and keep shoving it under the carpet, your emotional carpet starts looking like the Alps after a while. And then what can happen is you can have a tiny trigger, you know, and all of that stuff can absolutely spill out. But you're overreacting. You are overreacting for that time. But it's the last time. Do you remember the time when you did this, 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 or when you said that and that? It was 10 years, 4 hours, and 1 minute ago. I still remember it, because actually it was never really dealt with.
Yeah.
So there's this build up of emotion. And we have been told in the past, emotion is bad, so squash it. What we're now saying is emotion is important. Recognize it. And then learn how to deal with it intelligently. So it's the integration, the absolute integration of head and heart. If you recognize your emotion, you might be able to deal with it instead of just bursting out in an uncontrollable way. So, I mean, just ask me your question again, because I'm
You know, when people use emotion as an excuse for bad behavior or for losing it or being self-indulgent.
Well, it's very immature to be able to do that. You know, you can kind of forgive that if you are very young, because you just act out emotionally. When you get older, there have to be consequences to your behavior, irrespective of whether it was sparked by emotion. You were emotional, but certainly, you know, recognize that kind of feeling and learn there are strategies and learn how to create a gap between the stimulus and response. You know, when you act out like that, it's called, there's a term, interesting term actually, it's called amygdala hijack or emotional hijack.
I remember you've discussed this with us.
I've discussed it before, I think, in terms of, of the Oscar thing, where you just get triggered and there is no gap between the stimulus and response, so you just act out. But for most of us, you need to create a tiny little gap, even a second, where you recognize the feeling and you, as an adult person, develop some sort of better ways than just acting out in an uncontrolled way of dealing with that feeling. Take a breath, think about what you're doing, be angry but not destructive, you know. And I think in the heat of the moment, that's quite a call. It's not always that easy.
It's tough.
But you also can't condone people just, they're not for, you know, you can't just say, I'm going to burn the White House down because I don't like this.
Yeah.
You're an adult person. Mm. So you might say, I wish I could burn the White House down. There's a difference between a thought and an action. You know, I'm very, very angry, very angry. I can't tolerate this, and this is what I feel like. But you don't translate it into throwing all of your proverbial toys out of a car.
Yeah, tantruming.
Tantruming as a grown-up person. You're allowed to own your feelings. But you're not allowed to act on them in a destructive way when you're grown up.
I read an interesting article the other day that we're more emotionally intelligent than we've ever been as humans. Do you agree with that? I mean, there might be some of it that we've gained and some that we've lost. I reckon that there might have been quite a lot of emotional connection and a lot of EQ around the campsite of our early ancestors, because you really had to read people very well to figure out what was going on around you. And Mabali read an article this morning about how our intelligence peaked some 6,000 years ago and has been in decline ever since. So there are different opinions about this.
I think it's a very interesting thing. My first answer is that I don't really know. I need to think about what it is. I think there's more emphasis on it. But, you know, if you look at things that get published every now and then, like I know that Forbes do it every now and then, where they talk about the 10 most successful people in the world.
Yeah.
And usually they're the criteria that you would imagine, or that you would imagine, you know, that we all look for. What does success really mean? And often we use three basic criteria. It's to do with power and influence, money, lot of money, and status. And the interesting thing in relation to your question is, when you look at them, you often associate those kind of things with being very, very clever, having a very high intelligence. But it's the kind of intelligence, the last 10 that I was quite long ago, because I know that Stephen Jobs was on it, so it was long ago. But there were only 3 university degrees, actually, amongst those so-called 10 most successful people in the world. So this is the part that relates to what you're saying. What did they have? What were the characteristics that ran like a golden thread through all of these people who were actually successful? And they all fell under what you're talking about now, emotion and intelligence. So what does that mean? That means, as I said, how do you recognize your feelings and the integration of head and heart? There were things like adaptability and flexibility. So how can you, adapt and roll and bounce back and resilience and so on? Interpersonal skills, you know, how do you relate to other people in the long term? I mean, how do you measure that kind of importance of the relationship? Intrapersonal skills would be to do with tolerance, stress management, all of those kind of skills, which are actually non-cognitive skills and attributes, not to do with book learning, to do with coping with life, to doing with street smarts, to doing with relationships with other people. Those all fall under those kind of skills that are important for coping today and that are important for success.
This is a fascinating discussion in terms of just how complicated human beings are. Like we're such a, it's amazing we can even get up in the mornings.
You know, I don't know. I think that in a sense we are complicated, but you know what I'm going to say. Finish my sentence. In a sense, we're not. What do we want, really? You know, we started off this whole discussion with the importance of recognition. We want to matter. We want to be heard. We want to feel. In fact, that's what I found quite interesting about that very short little blog that you sent. You know, I mean, if you want to build your body, that's how we start, to just go to the gym. If you want recognition and your recognition, go and see a therapist. We want kind of connection, you know, and recognition. We do want it. Again, it's so what do we want? We complicated, but we simple. You know, who are we? Yes, you know, we want to matter. I think we wired for connection. As human beings, we are wired for connection. If we can't hold some kind of esteem and there's a hole in our emotional bucket, such that we will do what Oscar Wilde said, you know, love me, hate me, but don't ignore me. Yep. And I'll be destructive because I want to be recognized. You know, I went through my own little journey very recently with thinking about this, because my whole computer's been contaminated by a virus.
Where have you been? I mean, it just sounds horrendous.
It really,
the way you say that, it sounds so bad. Contaminated.
Well, let me tell you that it's probably, I would go as far as saying, it's amongst the top three worst things that have ever happened to me. I really mean it, Gareth. You know, the whole I thought that I was backed up and everything. I've lost all of this stuff. But in relation to this discussion, started thinking, so who wants to do this? What are the minds like of people? They don't know me. So it's not personal. It wasn't a ransom virus, so there's no money. What is it for? You know, why? What is the need of people who want to be so absolutely incredibly destructive, you know, with this? For some kind of negative recognition, for power. Positive is best. But if I'm feeling stuck in my room like, you know, a Brussels sprout that is rotting or whatever it is, I'll show the world that I can do stuff.
So you think it's just an angry... I mean, how dare this person contaminate the computer of Dr. D?
Well, they don't even know me, and nor do they even care. And that's a dangerous state of the world. The power that is in the hands of people
that they can act out on because
they're angry.
I'm curious about something. You said this is among the top...
No, really.
Things that have ever happened that upset.
Okay, maybe I'm being emotional, I should recognize my feelings, what triggered them and why, and deal with them intelligently. You know, sure, I mean, we're talking about amongst loss and amongst things that happen, you know, in your life and amongst things that you have to deal with. But it's a really bad thing, because if you think of many, many years of presentations, confidential documents.
Oh, all your documents have been wiped out?
Everything, including photographs and absolutely everything. So, you know, you can get it back, which I've got it back, but all in raw data form. Which means in no files, in no anything. But the point of what I'm saying is, why? Why do people want to do this? Why? It's not for money. No one asked me for anything. No. It's for power. Why do you want the power? Because I can. Why do you want to act out? Because you can. Because I want to be able to wield this kind of power over other people. Why do you want to? Because I want to be recognized. You'll remember me because of what I was able to do.
But the weirdest part about this in particular is you don't even know who to give that negative recognition to.
No.
You don't know who the person is who invented this. It's so insidious.
Absolutely true. It's so insidious. And that's why, you know, Tom Friedman, who wrote that book, Hot, Flat, and whatever it was, you know, he said in the talk that I heard, and maybe because of where I was at with dealing with this, that's what I latched onto at the end of his talk. Today, more than ever, the golden rule of life has to apply, you know, and it's for you, because of the destructive power that is in the hands of so many people because of tech, you know, and technology and the social media. How do you instill in them some kind of moral compass or conscience of how to deal with your feelings more appropriately than destroying other people's data, a bank, a world, whatever it is, you know?
How did you...
How do you?
If you're a parent and you you're putting this into your kids. How do you start with that? I mean, we haven't got a lot of time left, but I'm fascinated by this.
Well,
you've got children. How does it, because it's daunting as a parent to teach them how to be better than you. You want them to be better than you.
It's a hell of a thing, and I think it always has been. And I think that today people are thinking that it's less incumbent on them, not more incumbent on them, because of social media and because of technology and TVs that become babysitters and parents who out of necessity have to work. You know, these kind of things like a conscience doesn't just develop automatically like sitting does or like standing does or like smiling does. You know, it comes from input that you get. And so, you know, you're not born with a kind of a conscience or an ability to learn right or wrong. So there are two main ways. You know, one way is that you have to be the change you wish to see in the world. And if you want to be a parent, that's what Gandhi said. You have to be what you think they want, that you want them to be. Because how do kids learn? There are three ways, Gareth, that they learn.
Tell me.
Example.
Yeah.
Example.
An example.
And example. So it's very difficult to not be how you want them to be. I mean, it's very easy not to. And then there's a way of, if you don't, if you lose it, or if you behave in a way that you wouldn't want them to do. Some parents find it very difficult to say, you know what, I messed up.
Can I?
I'm really sorry.
Yeah,
I made a mistake.
Can I at this point just refer to someone who I really do think lived that precisely? And I'm not a... You know, I get accused of being a fanboy and all the rest of it, but Barack Obama seems to have tried to do that. He did it with his own daughters. He's done it with America. He set the example. Very, very high EQ, this guy.
I think...
Angry as he must have been sometimes, never showed it.
I think that he was amazing as a human being. Mm. He had dignity. He set example. He showed respect of other people. He was mindful of them. You know, I think that as that... There's a difference, and people like to mix them all up because they think that if they don't like someone's policies, they don't like them. Or if they don't like them, their policy, if they do like them, their policies must be amazing. Who you are is often reflected in what you do, but who you are is much more reflected in how you do it. Mm. So you might not always agree with everything that he's done or whatever it is, but he maintained himself. I think that it's a great example that you do. So how, you know, you have to set an example and then you have to intervene from the time they're very young.
Well, here's what he said about his daughters, because the last question he was asked as president at a press conference by the reporter who'd asked him the first question back in Springfield, Illinois. This is what came out. She said to him, this member of the press, she said, "The First Lady put the stakes of the 2016 election in very personal terms. And she spoke about the concerns of women and LGBT people, people of color, among others. And I wonder how you and the First Lady are talking to your daughters about the meaning of this election and how you interpret it for yourself and for them." I mean, it's a very thoughtful question. And Obama took a second and he said the following. And I just think this is pretty smart. He said, "It was really interesting to see how Malia and Sasha reacted. They paid attention to what their mom said during the campaign and they believed it because it's consistent with what we've tried to teach them in our household. What I've tried to model as a father, the example thing you spoke about, and their mom, and what we've asked them to expect from the future boyfriends or spouses. But what we've also tried to teach them is resilience and tried to teach them hope. And we've tried to tell them that the only thing that is at the end of the world is the end of the world."
Mm.
"And you get knocked down, you get up, you brush yourself off, and you get back to work." And that tended to be their attitude.
Look, I think that that's amazing. I mean, people might be saying, yeah, that was studied, you know, very prepared. He knew he was going to get it.
She was going to ask him something else. She threw this in at the last minute.
I tend to, you know, I would believe it. And I think that they've done a good job. That doesn't mean that you don't lose it sometimes or you're the perfect child sometimes or, you know, you don't freak out or whatever. There's a way of stepping back, saying I messed up, even as a parent, saying, as I said, I'm sorry. What does that do? That teaches your kids that, you know, you can do that too. If my dad, who's the president and supposed to know anything, can say, you know what, I overreacted.
Mm.
I made a mistake. I should have listened to you. All of that gets internalized by them when you when, and conscience isn't something that you're just naturally born with. It's something that gets instilled as you're growing up. And now with the power of the social media, which is what we were talking about, the destructive nature. I mean, Gareth, you know, I found, and this was, it was about 3 or 4 years ago, I think, was my kids, my twins were very much, where they were little. It was on the day before the Jewish Day of Atonement, which means that you ask forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
I see my kids, my daughter typing away, texting. I said, Gemma, what are you doing with all of this? She said, I'm connecting with all my friends, 500,000 of them, to say that if I did anything wrong in the year, or if I upset you in the year, I'm sorry. Group text, millions of people, if I did anything to upset you, I'm sorry. So now I'm thinking about it. My immediate reaction is, you know, you're supposed to think about what you've done. You're supposed to look at the person in the eye. You're supposed to feel guilty. It's not supposed to be easy in 10 minutes and say, look, I'm sorry now. I'm on my high horse and on my way again. And then someone else said to me, you know, she wouldn't have accessed more than about 2 or 3 people before.
Now she can do this.
So now she can do that whole scale, you know, still think about the importance of being able to do that. So maybe we long on quantity, a little bit shorter on quality, perhaps. It's still given you that kind of access. And I think that that you sort of, so as a parent, you know, still have, I mean, you can break up with someone in a text.
Yeah.
You can say, I love you, which used to be quite awkward, and you could you felt all how am I going to say it? You know, what am I? There's this sort of build up. How do I approach it? Now I can text quickly now. Da 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 da. Put the phone down. I might not even have to look at the response.
Right.
You know, so all of these kind of things that I think help build character, help build connection, help build empathy, are being diluted. They're making it more widespread, but being diluted. And we need to counteract that because of human awareness and interaction that shouldn't be ignored because of the social media, but should rather be enhanced
because of it. What a perfect way to end it with that story about your daughter too. Mm. I mean, if we started the discussion there and we brought it right the way around. I hope it's been interesting for you, and Dr. D, you're always fascinating to talk to, so thank you very much for coming to spend some time
love
with us.
Love talking with you, Gareth.
And Dr. D will probably make another return here very, very soon. We always have reasons to talk to her.
We'll find reasons.
You better believe it.
Look for one.
Oh, damn right. All right, let's wrap it up with the UN News for this morning. Timothy Maurice is next. CliffCentral.com.